Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Kevin Mackin.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And once again, we've got a couple of topics we're going to be discussing. And we have a very special guest talking about adaptive mountain biking. And that is Andrew Ladawi, who we will hear from later in the show. But I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, John, before we get underway, I have to just revert back to a previous podcast where you may remember we were having a go at the FIH competitions committee and all these committees flying to Lausanne to have meetings. Well, one of the competitions committee contacted me and basically said that Thierry Vail, who is the CEO of the FIH, wanted them to have a phone hookup, that they decided that no, they would rather all meet in Lausanne because they feel that they are more effective when they meet in Lausanne. And this particular person also advised me that there is money apparently allocated. So the way it works is Oceania allocates some money every year for their representatives to go to meetings in Lausanne. And if you are, say, an Australian or a New Zealand representative on one of these committees, then the national body also sets aside some money so that that delegate can attend the meetings in Lausanne. So the FIH are not paying for those committee members to travel to Lausanne for meetings. It is in fact the national associations or the confederations that are paying for them to go.
Okay. That's good to know. It's all clear now.
It is indeed. I still wonder whether they need to go quite as often.
That's another argument.
It is indeed. Am I getting a start?
You start this week.
Okay, look, the thing I want to start with, John, and I know that it's been in the media a lot lately, and let's first of all say Steve Smith won the Ashes almost single-handedly. Fantastic performance, unbelievable batting from him. But then, of course, now the thing that really seems to have got under a lot of people's skin is the comment that people have said he is still a cheat. And my view is, look, he is a phenomenal batsman. Hopefully, if he continues to perform the way he is, that cheating stigma diminishes over time. The fact is he did something wrong, as have done many, many other athletes. And if you think of Diego Maradona, who many people would say was the greatest footballer to walk the earth, but again, he punched the ball into the net past England. So he will always be known as a cheat, and that will always diminish a lot of the accolades that are probably due him because of that one action in that one game. Maybe some other actions as well off the pitch, but that's another thing. But I mean, if you look at Ben Johnson, he was a cheat, and he has to live with the fact that he broke the rules. And there are, the history of sport is littered with people who've done that. I mean, you can go back to 1976. Do you remember Boris Onyshenko, who was the in the pentathlon, the man from the Ukraine?
Oh.
Maybe you're a bit too young. And he rewired his epee for the fencing.
That's right.
So that it lit up when he hadn't actually made contact. Now, again, the fact that I remember that, and that was 1976 that happened, yet I can still remember this guy. And in 1976, I can tell you, I wasn't even a teenager. But I still remember that.
I think the worst case of cheating I can think of is the Spanish Paralympic basketball team.
Absolutely, that
for
was disgraceful.
For reasons that went and had long-lasting ramifications for people far beyond this, you know, this basketball or sport. It really ruined a lot of opportunities for a lot of people. And it's only now we're starting to see a lot of intellectually disabled sports people being out, you know, allowed to compete again in all sorts of realms, and that's the worst cheating I can think of. But you're talking too about defining someone as a cheat, and the way that Steve Harmison said it and others is Steve Smith will always be defined as being a cheat, whereas I don't think that will define it.
I don't
Steve
think
Smith.
It will either,
and it should.
But he will always have that sadly attached to his
look,
name,
and it's part of the story. You'll never be able to tell the Steve Smith's story, in all honesty, without including that. And it's the same as Maradona. You can't take away that little moment from his story. You have to be honest about it being in there. Yes, he did cheat, but that's not the defining moment of Diego Maradona's career, necessarily. It's just a major highlight, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, look, let's, I know there's some people who go, oh, you know, you're a POM, you're just saying that because you're a POM. But no, Michael Vaughan shouldn't have, I mean, Michael Atherton shouldn't have done the dirt in the pocket. I still to this day don't know why he did when there's dirt at the crease that you can just put your hand in that.
If you want to go back, how about WG Grace? What a gentleman he was.
But the thing is, John, again, I, funnily enough, I just read a book about WG Grace, and a lot of it is unsubstantiated or apocryphal. They don't actually know. Some of the stories have become bigger and bigger and have become myth. But if you want to talk about one that I feel is really hardly done by, or was very hardly done by in his lifetime, and that was Douglas Jardine, because he didn't actually cheat. He was within the rules. He bowled, and in fact, if you look, it was Jack Scott of South Australia who bowled bodyline at the British in 1928 when they came out for the Ashes tour, and that was first time that they'd ever experienced it. Now, you know, Jardine was told, go out there, win the Ashes. He came up with a tactic that he thought could restrict Don Bradman. He won the Ashes. He had great bowlers in that, you know, the fact that Larwood moved to Australia and was respected so much over here for the rest of his entire life.
Yeah.
I think says something about that. But Jardine had to live with that, and he actually did nothing wrong. And that's one of the things I find actually quite sad. And if you look into his life, I mean, he was an eccentric guy, but I think he was also a remarkably strong character.
Yeah, it's an interesting, I mean, Bradman still averaged 50 something in that series, so it's interesting. I mean, most people, when they average 50, they go, oh gee, we probably shouldn't try that tactic anymore.
But the interesting thing as well about that series, which nobody really ever, I think, you know, I'm fascinated by the whole bodyline thing, was, but if every Australian batsman had in every innings been given the score that their average was at the end of their career, so Bradman 99 point, you know, they still wouldn't have scored enough runs to beat England.
Yeah.
So that's quite an interesting stat, I think.
I think a bodyline offer gets blown away by that series, by the bowling of Larwood, and doesn't concentrate enough on some of the great batting that was going on from the Englishmen as well. I mean, they did pretty good on that tour.
Yeah, exactly. But it is a hard one, I mean, John, because there, you know, Steve Smith, sadly, you know, he was involved. He was the captain, and the buck stops with the captain. He actually said that, you know, and he wasn't strong enough when he came back. And so he's at least accepted, in my book, I respect him because he's accepted responsibility. He suffered his penalty, and he's now come back stronger, and we touched on this before, and I think he's going to be, he basically now wants to try and wipe the slate clean by being the best batsman we've ever seen. And I think at the moment he's showing that he can do that, and with any luck he'll continue to do that. But sadly, he will always have that little asterisk or whatever it is where people will refer to that. It'll never be forgotten.
No, and neither should it be forgotten. It's part of the Steve Smith story. If it had never happened, who knows where we'd be at the moment. Maybe he would have just made a run of ducks in this Ashes Terrace.
But I do think, John, some of the Australian public have been a little bit precious about this, saying, you know, that it's the POMs throwing mud and whatever. And Australia has had a history of several athletes, you know, who've broken the rules over a period of time. And, you know, to me, it's, you know, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And that applies to the British as well, because they've had people that have not played by the rules. But, I mean, the one that springs to mind is the man who just loved a cup of coffee, you know, Alex Watson.
Oh, at the Olympics, yeah.
Yeah, was he pentathlon as well, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yeah. I think, wasn't it something to do with fencing as well? It was during the fencing part of the competition, and he was just chugging down them caffeines.
Yeah, I mean, the more cups of coffee than you've ever had in your life.
Probably more than medically recommended.
Yeah, but look,
but no country's immune from it.
Absolutely,
you know,
not.
Lance Armstrong, cheat, big cheat. I think you can, you know, he's one of the few cheats that you can definitely label that defines his career.
And he still won't admit it or give his jerseys back or anything.
Yeah,
like that, you know?
Well, you know, they'll be worth a lot of money one day. I've got a real Lance Armstrong cheating jersey. It'll be at auction. But sometimes people are just, you can use they cheated in that instance, but they're not a cheat.
Yeah.
Sometimes your mind does funny things. You know what? Cheating for me could be sticking my foot out on a hockey field and letting it hit my foot when, if I hadn't moved my foot, it would have gone straight past me. Professional foul is essentially cheating.
Absolutely, it is.
So there's There's degree of cheat. Should we put it that way?
Yep, there are. There are levels of cheating.
This is Gary Lineker, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, well, I'm very pleased that our guest on this podcast is a gentleman we've had on the show several times before. He is a man I have the utmost respect for in the way he dealt with his disability after it happened, how he's got on with his life, and boy, has he got on with his life. Andrew Ladawi, as we'll hear, broke his back as a mountain biker, and since then he's got back on in the saddle and has really created so much buzz around adaptive mountain biking. So that is for athletes with a disability to be able to go out there, or not even athletes, but people who want to get out there and do mountain biking with a disability. And he's now set up the very first adaptive mountain biking centre at Kalamunda Mountain Bike Trail in Western Australia. So it's great to be catching up with Andrew Ladawi once again.
Andrew Ladawi, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks, Ash. Great to be back.
Well, it's good to catch up with you once again, and I think you've been very busy since we last spoke, but I wanted to sort of take you back to the first time we ever had you on the show, and you were explaining how you were a mountain biker, very passionate about the sport, and then one day, and I think it was 2008, your life literally changed on the track.
Yeah, when I first got in touch with you, that was 2013, but 5 years prior to that, I just had an unfortunate accident on a regular mountain bike ride, went over the handlebars, landed real badly, and just on impact, shattered my vertebrae and, paralyzed from the waist down from that point on. So, it was a bit of a journey from there until when we caught up, which was 2013, and that's when the mountain biking bug bit me in the bum again and reignited that passion.
Well, yeah, you go back to 2013, and that was when you found out that there were obviously hand cycles that you could go off-road with, and it meant that despite being paralyzed from the waist down, you could get back out there and enjoy mountain bike riding again. And you took part, I think, that year in the Cape to Cape, which is obviously a big race down south here in Western Australia.
That's right, yeah. We wanted to really showcase the capacity of the equipment, and the equipment was really one of the key elements to gaining access to the outdoors and the mountain bike trails again. And, yeah, we used the Cape to Cape mountain bike, which is a four-day stage event, to showcase the equipment as well as the attitude that we have behind Break the Boundary and just the mountain bike community in general. So, yeah, we decided to do something a little bit wild and crazy, and from there we did five consecutive Cape to Cape mountain bike races, and from there in the last 3 or 4 years we've had new participants come on board, which is great to see. So it's not just the Andrew Ladawi show, it's the everyone that wants to do adaptive mountain biking show.
But I'm sure, Andrew, you doing that and obviously getting hold of one of these bikes, that probably inspired a lot of people. And I mean, but they're not cheap bikes to get, are they? They're quite expensive to actually bring into Australia.
Well, that's it. None of this equipment is unfortunately made in Australia, so then it comes with all kinds of challenges, costs, logistics. It's really hard to, trial something when it doesn't exist in the country. Really just gives us no option other than to fly internationally to try equipment. So there was a lot of guesswork early on, but fortunately at the time we did have Dan, who does live in Perth, who did have one bit of equipment, which we sort of started with that. And as the technology improved, our knowledge of adaptive mountain biking grew as well. So new technology started emerging on the market. It did lower the price a little bit, but it's still sitting at the sort of $9,000 to $15,000 mark for an entry-level adaptive mountain bike.
Have you found that you've sort of ended up being the go-to man when it comes to adaptive mountain biking in Australia, that everyone knows your story and so comes to you and goes, how can I get involved?
Yeah, and it's still that case at this stage, where I get a lot of clubs, a lot of government departments, local councils, advocacy groups, disabilities, service providers, all constantly contacting us. And It is at the point now where Break the Boundary has expanded a little bit, and there are other people who have a high level of information and knowledge and experience with the adaptive mountain biking. So it's good to be able to have other faces to really, you know, inform people in the public and the community of the equipment and the capacity and limitations with some of the equipment, but also, you know, how far they can actually go.
I remember when we spoke to you sort of after that 2013 conversation, you were trying to get mountain bikers to put GoPros on the front of their bikes so that you could see the tracks that might to be able to be used by the adaptive mountain biking community. What's the reaction been from the able-bodied mountain bikers? Have they been really supportive and helpful in that vein?
Yeah, absolutely. The video footage goes a very, very long way to visualise things. And also, you know, hear the excitement and the audio that comes with it. People tend to see that it's more of a fun adventure rather than a difficult challenge. But it's quite surprising the types of trails that we can actually access are very similar to the existing mountain bike networks. And, yeah, the non-disabled community has really jumped on board. There's been a lot of support. We have a range of volunteers. We have also a few regular support riders that are dead keen on coming out on board to help us out with some of the manual lifting, things like transferring and picking us up if we do sort of take a bit of a tumble. And, yeah, I mean, we really do rely on the great amount of bike community, and we just feel like we're just part of that family now. It's just it's almost common knowledge that adaptive mountain bikers are just sort of doing what mountain bikers do.
The one thing that I look at you, Andrew, and I know when we spoke that first time and you were a little bit nervous getting back out there, but you're now absolutely throwing yourself in it. But did you ever imagine you'd be taking the sport where you've taken it now with Break the Boundary?
I did imagine that. I mean, that's sort of been the goal right from the beginning. Initially, it was about proving it to myself. And after doing Cape to Cape a few times and then finishing all four stages, that was sort of the aha moment where I realized, well, if I can do it, then I'm sure plenty of other people can do it. And then from that point on, a few years after I very first got my eyes and hands on adaptive mountain bike, it was really just about pushing out. The long-term goal was about, you know, let's spread this out across the country so that other people can experience, you know, the joy of being out in the bush and really breaking the boundary and going beyond the limitations of a wheelchair or a disability.
Well, the exciting news really, and one of the reasons we're catching up now is, you know, you've managed to find a place where you can actually call home, and you're setting up the Kalamanda Mountain Bike Trail, and it'll be the first adaptive mountain biking trail in Australia. I mean, how much time and effort has it taken to get to this stage? Because the official opening is not that far away now.
That's right. On the 4th of October, we will be opening the very first adaptive trail hub of its kind in the country. And again, the long-term plan is hopefully to have a few of these jotted around in some of the main mountain bike trail networks around the country. And it's really a place, it is a home, and it really, it's there to curb a lot of the logistical problems that we've had when we've run programs, clinics, and camps. It's really a nice central point where it's embedded within the regular mountain bike community and some of the other off-road activities like trail walking. We've picked this location specifically for that reason. It just really integrates people with disabilities so that, hey, we're not doing things somewhere far out in the bush that's separate and isolated from people. It's just part of, you know, day-to-day activities. And, yeah, it's been a long process. The idea did start back in September last year, 2018, sorry. And, yeah, it just really started off with a sketch on a bit of paper just saying, hey, we need a storage place to store some equipment and so that people can come down, look at the equipment, talk to someone that's experienced or has some background in adaptive mountain biking and try some of the equipment for the very first time and do it in one place so that they don't have to go from one place to another. It really just cuts down a lot of that guesswork for people. And yeah, from September, we started work on site around January this year. And here we are, 8-9 months down the track, 3 weeks away from grand opening day. So very exciting for the country, hopefully.
No, I mean, it's absolutely fantastic, and my hat goes off to you and everybody involved, but I'm sure that you've had support from local council, and I've seen on your Facebook page a lot of volunteers, and maybe it's an opportunity for you to thank them for all their help.
Yeah, look, it's been an interesting journey. Originally, we just wanted to go for big grant applications and really just fast track this whole process, and unfortunately we weren't successful with some of these big grant applications, and because of the nature of our activities and where we're operating, we're restricted to the funds that we could access through some of the larger government bodies and sporting organisations. So we sort of had to do it the hard way, but you know, the community came on board, small businesses came on board, individuals, you know, donated their hard-earned cash towards the project as well. We've had over 400 hours of in-kind volunteer labor work as well, from, you know, landscaping to painters to you know, guys like Sheds Down South who have given us a massive discount on a very big shed as well, and that's helped us, you know, save some of the costs and the funding that we have raised for some of the other aspects of the shed. So, look, I mean, if I was to thank people, it would probably take me half an hour, and we are saving it for the open day. So there's just too many people to thank, from businesses to individuals. It just, the list is massive. The city of Kalamunda has jumped on board from the get-go. They've supported us financially, but more so in connecting us with the greater network in the local community, and that's what's really driven this project and kept it sustainable. So it's it's a massive list of people, and we can't thank the people enough. So we're throwing an open day with free pancakes, sausage sizzle, bike rides, camel rides, to really thank those volunteers and all the people that have donated.
One thing you said there was, you know, you're hoping that this will be the first adaptive mountain biking sort of centre in Australia that will then grow and it will go elsewhere. Is it the fact that now there will be one, you can almost invite other states to sort of see this in operation and say, look, we can do this for you?
Absolutely. We want to set the benchmark here for the country and break the boundaries continually, going into new territory, uncharted territory. And as our name suggests, we're breaking that boundary. We're pushing it further and further out. And, yeah, we invite, you know, local governments from around WA, but also from other states and territories to come visit us. You know, we're 20 minutes from the airport. We're happy to pick people up and show them our local trails and the amenities and facilities that we have, show them the range of equipment that we have as well, and show them, here's a good example of how it can be done at a very small cost, but also with the support of the local community, and how easy something can get done when everyone pitches in just a little bit. A little bit goes a very long way with these sort of projects. So hopefully, yeah, it will cause a bit of a trickle on a dominoes effect around the country and really just provide opportunities for people around the country rather than having to travel, you know, jump onto a 6-hour plane flight or travel internationally or anything like that. It really just cuts out a lot of that and provides something a little bit more local to all the other states. So, yeah, this is the benchmark.
You were saying, you know, obviously a lot of people have donated money and funds and time. I mean, are you still requiring money to keep this going, or presumably you're going to need money down the track if you're going to get similar centres up and running? And if people are interested and want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
Yeah, look, we're probably about 75% to completion, so we've got 3 weeks to finish that sort of last 25%. But it's all the small bits and pieces, the intricate little bits that we don't really think about with the project. So things like electrical work, you know, planning for walls, floor surfaces, putting shelving in, workbenches, all the little bits and pieces. We still need a lot of support for that. And, yeah, we're still working on getting funds to cover the costs and just speed that last little leg of the race to complete it. So best way is to get in touch with us at info@breaktheboundary.com.au. Otherwise, our website, www.breaktheboundary.com.au/trail-hub, is the direct project page, which has all the information, a lot of photos of all the current volunteers and donors as well. Get in touch with us and we can see how people can potentially help us out and what's remaining on our, I guess, our shopping list.
Certainly, Andrew. I mean, I've known you a while now and you've always had this passion for the mountain biking. Is that still very much alive, or has it actually almost been revitalized and it's actually greater than it ever was?
I think it's given me a much greater appreciation for the opportunities that we do have in this country. I think we've got a great country with a lot of support from the local community. Sitting behind a laptop and sort of just making sure everything's above board has taken my time away from actually doing the riding part of the whole project. So we're looking forward to wrapping things up so that we can just get back out on the trails and, get some dirt onto our bikes again. So, yeah, the committee and the volunteers have been working very, very hard behind the scenes, and yeah, we're looking forward to the day where we can just go out riding again, which is, you know, not far on board. And yeah, we're expanding from just mountain biking to off-road trail walking as well. So it's very similar to mountain biking in a lot of aspects, and the trails are quite similar. And yeah, we just really just want to get people outdoors and just share that passion with other people. So yeah, we're really looking forward to the open day.
Well, it's been quite a journey, Andrew, and I think you should be congratulated. It's fantastic where you've taken it from, first of all, just getting that bike and doing the Cape to Cape, to now having a dedicated centre, the first in Australia. I congratulate you, and I really hope it goes well for you.
Thanks a lot, Ash. And, yeah, look, thank you very much for all the support over the years. It's been a big marathon. It's not a sprint, but a marathon. And, yeah, you've been backing us up and cheering us on along the whole way. So, yeah, thank you for the support and having me on.
Absolute pleasure, and I hope the opening goes well.
Hi, I'm Mark Leduca, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not The Footy Show, and that was Andrew Ladawi, who is the main person behind Break The Boundary. And as you heard there, they are opening the very first adaptive mountain biking and trail walking hub in Kalamunda here in Western Australia. Now, the official opening is on Friday the 4th of October. It's an 8:30 a.m. if you can arrive then, and a 9 a.m. start. It's free to anybody who wants to turn up. They've got a sausage sizzle, free Dutch pancakes, free camel rides. But it is very important that you sort of let people know that you're going to go out there. But they're looking to get people, and this is just a fantastic thing. And obviously, Andrew is looking to expand this around the country. And if there's anybody listening anywhere, I would think overseas even as well, because we do have listeners from overseas, he is a great guy to talk to if you want to set up something similar in your country, where you can give people the chance who have a disability to get out there on mountain bike trails and actually on a hand cycle and enjoy what everybody else enjoys.
Remember when Andrew came to the studio and we were out at 990 and he had his bike on a trailer? What a beast of a machine it was. And I would even encourage what able-bodied, inverted commas, people, have a go at it. See how difficult it really is. And he's a jet of an athlete.
He is. I mean, the one story I remember when that particular time, because that was, I think, just after, it may have been actually just before he was doing the Cape to Cape for the first time. And then we caught up with him afterwards. And he was saying that the thing he'd forgotten about when he got on his trike, I suppose you'd call it, because it has obviously the two wheels at the back, was unlike mountain biking, because you're kneeling on the bike and then you're using your hands to pedal, he'd forgotten how close to the water and all the mud his face was and how all of this blew up in his face as he was going around. But, I mean, he's really got a passion for mountain biking, and that comes through in everything he says, John. And you know me, I love anybody that has a passion. We had Nick Kidd on the last show.
Yeah.
He has a passion for badminton. These people are people you just want to do well and you want to get involved with, because they live it, they breathe it, and they just want everyone else to get involved.
It's fantastic. Love it. My turn, isn't it?
It is indeed.
Oh, what are we going to talk about? Well, umpiring, refereeing, officiating. Are we going through a crisis across the sports globe in officiating? And I don't mean necessarily at the top end of the level. I mean throughout sport at the participatory level, I'd call it, where most people spend their time on a sports field. You know, what percentage of any sport makes it to the very, very top? Maybe 10% if you're lucky.
It's less than that. Yeah. I think it's 0.2% or something.
Will ever be elite. Now, there's probably a level below that, a couple of levels below that as well, where people aren't quite elite, but it's still very, the level of competition is high standard, very committed, etc.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about below maybe second or third grade, in those areas below that, where most people are competing. And I wonder if, once again, too much focus on what happens at the elite level and not enough at the grassroots levels of sport. And how much is that costing sport participants?
I think you've got a very, very good point there. I'll go slightly off the beaten track to try and illustrate the point I'm going to make.
Okay.
I have a school report from when I was 11 years old playing cricket, and it was criticising me as an 11-year-old for being too professional in my attitude. in my appealing. And what it was I raised my arm when I turned to the umpire and went, "How's that?" I was 11 years old. And I was told that that was not the done thing, but it was obviously what I'd seen on television. Now, what I'm trying to illustrate here is, again, I think what we're seeing now is the higher level is influencing the lower level, which I think is one of the points that you're trying to make. And also the players are being influenced by how they see the players react at the higher level in a number of sports. So then they react in a similar way, especially in a sport, say, like football, where they abuse the referee. And certainly that is a big problem with referees getting abused, at lower level sport. And I mean, there was a referee, I think, earlier this season actually took a team off and then was threatened to be beaten up by parents and whatever. But he was actually appraised for what he did because they reckon it was the right thing to do. And he was only 17. So to do that, I think I'd take my hat off. He had a lot of guts to do that.
I wonder about the responsibility that we give youngsters to be the match officials. And it's always been in my mind that you shouldn't be trying out young referees on young kids, because young kids actually need the best referees. It's in those developmental early stages of their sporting careers where they need the best officiating to allow them to learn the skills properly.
And the rules.
And
when you're young, you don't read the rule book, come on.
No, they've got no idea. But children learn to get away with being lazy as far as their skill set and the rules go. And I've seen, say, in the case of hockey where, you know, almost a whole game of hockey without one stick check being blown. Now, that doesn't happen at the elite level. But what these kids were learning was bad habits. They were learning that that's okay. That's the way you tackle. Not being penalised for it and being told and taught the proper way to tackle.
I think the thing that I find interesting, John, and again, it's to me, it's a circumstance of society as well as a whole. If you look, society now does not like one-on-one communication. They like to have it on a text or an email. And it's a fact that people are very poor communicators today. So suddenly you're throwing a youngster who tends to use electronic devices to communicate to officiate a game, who maybe doesn't have the communication skills required to carry out that job to the best of their ability. And to me, that is a really big issue. And where we should be focusing a lot of the training is not necessarily on their understanding of the rules, but on how they should communicate to players to get across their interpretation of the rules.
I just think we're missing something somewhere. And across a lot of sports, not just one sport, but there's a gap that exists. And let's face it, the top umpires would have been a top umpire whether they'd gone to course A, B or C or not. They would still be the top umpire. Some people just have it in them to be able to operate as an umpire at that level. Other people never will. But it doesn't mean they can't learn the skill set to enable them to operate as an umpire at a lower level. And I just wonder sometimes if we're not throwing too many eggs into the basket for the kiddies. Let them be players.
I think some of it as well, John, and we touched on this on a previous podcast, so I forgive if our listeners will forgive me a little bit, but I think some of it, again, that what has happened is at the higher level, because there is so much focus, what we're seeing now, and I think you see this also sometimes when there are referee adjudicators, assessors are at a game, that you see referees or umpires officiating truly to the letter of the law. Whereas the way that the sport has been over the years is there are times where, yes, you can play an advantage there. You don't have to blow up so early. And I think where we're seeing this is again, this almost at the highest level, this judgment of the officials is so intense that we're now finding that we're blowing up things and the games aren't flying as much as they should. And there's also not that sort of relationship between the players and the umpires where the umpire can say, look, you got away with that one, no more. And I think there needs to be more of that. There needs to be more of a relationship between the players and the officials. And the other thing I look back on when I was playing, which we're going back a long time now, but I remember when I was playing rugby, we had a referee would come around the club at the beginning of the season and would explain. And if you weren't there as a player at that club, you were in serious trouble for that meeting. And if you gave away, say, a penalty in the first game because of one of the rules that were explained on that Thursday, you really got your butt kicked because you expected to be there. And the referees came in pre-season, explained, this is how we're going to be refereeing this rule. Any questions? And you had your chance to go, well, what if I do this? They go, no, that'll be a penalty. If I do that, you do that. But to me, that was actually really good. It was a very good setup, but whether it's feasible to be able to do it across all grades, all levels of the game, I don't know.
And just so people will not think that we're just bashing umpires here, I mean, umpires very often don't get help by associations and lawmakers within the game either. I mean, we've just seen a situation where the FIH has released its new indoor hockey rules. Well, I haven't read them, I must admit. But what was so wrong with the other ones that they had to rewrite or add or subtract whatever rules that they've done? And very often, especially in recent years, we're seeing small tinkerings to rules that don't really change much at all.
And dare I say, John, this is because if you have competitions or rules committees, they feel that they have to justify their place there. And they bloody make up changes that are totally pointless. And I'm sorry, I get infuriated with it because I'm with you. I think there is change for the sake of change. And a lot of the time it doesn't need it. And they actually complicate things.
Yeah, and they complicate it for umpires too and for players. And it'd be nice if you went along to your club for one of those meetings. Now, I know those sorts of meetings happen in hockey as well. We've had them down at Fremantle in previous years. Anyway, it would be great to go along to one of those meetings and the umpire goes, well, no rule changes this year, boys. It's the same as last year. Anybody got any questions about last year's rules? Oh, yeah, quite. Because players are the last people that really understand the rules.
But I also think, John, sometimes, and I think I've mentioned this previously and it might have been just in conversation, when we were live streaming the floorball, the national finals here in Western Australia last year, I went through the floorbook rules. Whoever wrote those, they get an A double plus. You read them once, you understand it immediately. It is clear. It is in plain English. Now, you can look at football rules, you can look at rugby rules, you can look at hockey rules, you know, all sports that I've had to commentate. And you sometimes have to read the rule three or four times to try and actually understand what they're trying to say.
Yeah.
Now, if you can't understand it the first time, then there's something wrong. It needs to be worded in a way that is simple for everybody to understand. Now, you mentioned the FIH, and I remember at the beginning of this year, they made a rule change. I was getting messages from international coaches going, can you explain this to me? Because I don't understand it.
Was that the 5 metre rule around the D?
I think it was. Yeah. It was certainly something around the circle anyway. And it was just, and I was getting, honestly, international coaches going, can you understand this? Because I don't. Now, if your international coaches who are the elitist of the elite, if they don't understand it, what's the chance of Johnny in D grade going to have of understanding it?
And the funny thing is that the way that that rule's worded, it's like, so is he allowed to tackle or is he not allowed to tackle? It's very difficult to work out exactly what's, so I've got to be making my way out of the space, but if he moves, I'm allowed to then move, but I've got to give him 5 yards, but I've got, it's just very complicated.
But here's an example, John. I don't know if this is a famous story. So croquet was televised once. I think it was on Channel 4 a long, long time ago, the World Croquet Championships. Didn't do it again because they said the rules were too complicated and viewers couldn't understand them. So there is a lesson for every sport, simplifying them. But as I say, floorball, you read their rules, so simple to understand and so easily written. And as I say, I take my hat off to them, I applaud them. And I just think there is a lesson in that for a lot of sports.
And I do like umpires.
Oh, look, I've had some brilliant cricket ones where you have a bit of banter, even good referees. You know, the only time I ever got booked in a game of football, you know, I called the referee a bloody idiot, and he goes, no, you are, and gave me a yellow card. And I went, yeah, fair enough.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over.
See ya, we'll be back next week.